This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In spite of all the advances of modern medicine, the human body still poses mysteries that have no obvious solutions or even explanations. My guest offers her own condition as an example. Siri Hustvedt is the author of the new book, The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. She's a novelist who's had several inexplicable episodes of violent shaking. It's not epilepsy, it's not panic attacks. And during a seizure, she can still think and speak clearly. Hustvedt also has a long history of migraines. One of them lasted a full year. She writes, neurological and psychiatric illnesses seem to attack the very source of what one imagines is one's self. Her memoir is in part about how her migraines and seizures have affected her sense of self. Her book also investigates her condition from the perspectives of psychology, psychiatry, neurology, and literature. The second time she had a seizure, it was while giving a speech. Her husband, the writer Paul Auster, was in the audience. So we asked Paul Auster to join us for the very first part of the interview. So, Paul, I'd like to start by asking you to describe the first time you saw Siri having a shaking seizure. What did it look like? What was your experience of that?
Well, I knew it had happened once in Minnesota, but I wasn't present. And then about 6 months later, Siri and I were invited to a literary festival in Key West, Florida. So it was early 2007, January. Siri had written a piece about her shaking. It was actually the kernel of the book that has now been published. And she wanted to give a lecture about this. There was a large crowd in the hall, a few hundred people. And she got up to begin speaking. And out of nowhere, her body started to shake. And I'm not saying tremble. These were not tremors. This was violent, almost epileptic, seizure-like movements. Her arms were flapping. Her legs seemed to be knocking together. But what was so uncanny about what I was seeing was that she was able to go on speaking. It seemed that what was happening from her neck down was very different from what was happening in her head. So she gripped the podium very tightly and went on talking and said, and this is where it got really bizarre, I'll get to the shaking in a minute, because there were people in the audience. There were people in the audience saying she's having a seizure. And there was a lot of alarm. I myself was so terrified to see her in this condition. I was sitting next to Ian McEwan, the English novelist who was at the festival as well, who's an old friend. And I leaned over to Ian. I said, I have to go up on stage and take Siri off because this is horrible. And Ian, cool Englishman that he is, just said, no, I think she's going to be okay. Give her a minute or two and let's see what happens. And it is true that by gripping the podium and continuing to speak, she did settle down. And by the middle of the speech, she was pretty much under control. But it was a horrifying thing to see in someone you love so much, in public no less. And I'll never forget it.
Well, Paul, thanks for that description. We'll let you go now so that I can
talk
with Siri.
Thank you.
Well, Siri, now that we've heard your husband, Paul Auster, describe what it was like to watch you, tell us what your experience was of having that seizure on stage.
It's hard to describe how surprising it is, for one thing. It comes out of nowhere. And the first time it happened, I opened my mouth to speak, and suddenly my whole body is shuddering violently. I had index cards in my hand. My arms were flapping. My legs were shuddering so hard that I thought I was going to fall over. It's a very dramatic physical event. But what was fascinating and has always been fascinating about this for me is that my cognitive abilities, in other words, my thoughts, my ability to talk continues. I don't feel cloudy or anything. It's simply that my limbs have gone out of control.
And your mind, being cognizant at the time, must be thinking, make it stop. How do I control it? And of course, you can't control it.
You can't control it at all. In fact, I just clung to the podium to keep myself upright. And I did say to the audience, well, you know, I'm going to discuss the shaking problem and what it might be later in the discussion.
I love the way you postponed it until later.
So I said, yes, you know, I'm getting to it if you'll just bear with me. And fortunately, it did subside. And one of the strange questions is, did it subside because these stress hormones were ceasing to rush through my body and that was triggering this seizure-like activity? Or did the seizure just last for only a short time?
How many times has this happened to you?
It's happened 4 times. And I began to think that I was having some kind of hysterical seizure activity. In other words, that I had no control over it, but that it was maybe completely related to some emotional drama inside me that I had no awareness of, especially because the first time this happened was when I was giving a speech about my dead father at a memorial. They were planting a tree in his honor at the college where he had been a professor. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, this is coming out, you know, some unconscious emotional conflict what's going on. However, later I had a seizure when I was climbing a mountain. I think I hyperventilated and it triggered a seizure. So that seemed to suggest that it's not only emotional material or fear of public speaking that initiates this.
You've also had severe migraines most of your life, and you suspect that it's connected. You write that people with migraines are often prone to other peculiar sensations and to sensitive nervous systems. In your 30s, you say that you started to get this strange tingling in your arms and legs with shocks of varying degrees going up and down your limbs and your face. Do you think all of that is connected, that and the seizures?
I have a feeling that it is. I don't think that neurology can explain exactly how these are related. They do know some things. For example, that if you have either migraine or epilepsy, you have a much greater chance of having both of them. In other words, there has to be some kind of connection, but they're not certain how that works. It does seem that something like migraine is inherited, that there's a strong genetic component to it, and probably with epilepsy as well. Although I have to say, epilepsy too can be triggered by emotional content. I read, after I had finished the book, a wonderful little medical story about a man who has epilepsy and he has a seizure every time he lies.
Wow.
it's amazing.
So what kind of difficulty have you run into getting a diagnosis for your seizures when it doesn't fit any of the symptoms of known illnesses? They've ruled out epilepsy. It doesn't seem to be stage fright. It doesn't fit any of the official illnesses and disorders. So where does that leave you?
Well, it leaves me, I think, with the fact that I do take beta blockers or propranolol every time I have some public event, and this seems to inhibit the seizing activity. So that's a good thing. So that leaves me at least with a crutch. The interesting thing about this is that there are a lot of illnesses that are either misdiagnosed or seem to fall outside the categories of medicine. That's simply a truism. I feel that my journey and part of the writing of this book for me was a sense of mastering not the illness, not curing it, but being able to think very clearly about what had happened to me and also saying to myself, this is part of you. This is not only part of your story, but it belongs to your nervous system. It may never go away. And it became very important for me to own it, to take it into myself as part of myself and not as an alien invader.
Well, let me quote something that you wrote. And this was actually in a New York Times article that you wrote a couple of years ago about migraine. You wrote, "Chronic headaches are my fate, and I have adopted a position of philosophical resignation. I am aware that such a view is resoundingly un-American. Our culture does not encourage anyone to accept adversity. On the contrary, we habitually declare war on the things that afflict us, whether it's drugs, terrorism, or cancer. The very moment I stopped thinking of my condition as the enemy, I made a turn and began to get better. I wasn't cured, wasn't forever well, but I was better. Metaphors matter." Can you talk about how you try to, instead of like conquering and fighting whatever this affliction is that you have, just kind of trying to accept it, and why you think that made a difference?
Well, I think for one thing, acceptance, even physiologically, has a calming effect on the body. In other words, if you're in a state of resignation or acceptance, you're less tense than if you're going to war. And I think with a number of illnesses, this is probably a somewhat healing factor. At the same time, I think, you know, diagnosis is really a way to abstract an illness from a person. And that can be quite easy, say with a cancerous tumor that can be removed, or with the measles that come and go. You have spots and then the spots leave you. With neurological illnesses, it's much more difficult to separate the illness from the person. And I do note in the book aspects of personality that seem to be very strongly related to the nervous system, including religious feeling, the need to write. Certain temporal lobe epileptic people get something called hypergraphia, which means that they just have to write a lot. And this is probably part of Dostoevsky's story as well. So I think where the nervous system begins or ends, and personality, these are very complicated questions.
Well, you know, you say that once you wanted to make peace with your nervous system, instead of like being in this constant state of combat, fighting it and worrying about it, you needed a deep reset. What was the reset button that you used?
Well, I think it has to do with these questions of who we are, what we are. I think very much we all have a story that we tell ourselves about ourselves. We are always building narratives out of memory all the time. And those narratives are probably not exactly the truth. Memory is not something that is perfect. It's an imperfect business. But we need some kind of narrative in order to live with ourselves. And the narrative that I was trying to construct for myself, the reset button, if you will, is that this story of illness is one, first of all, that's not killing me. I have to say that's a good thing so far. And but it's also a story that is not altogether horrible and negative. And I do think that aspects of my nervous system that have given me a lot of trouble, certain kinds of hypersensitivity, have also been an aid to me in my work as a writer and novelist. So there are often two sides to what appears to be a wholly negative story.
Okay, so You're talking about the story you tell yourself of who you are when something's gone wrong inside with your body.
Yes, yes.
So when something goes wrong, your narrative kind of becomes, I'm scared, I'm vulnerable, maybe I'm kind of a freak because no one can even diagnose what this is. So how did you get rid of that tape loop in your head?
Well, I think possibly because I had suffered from migraines for many years, and they are chronic. I don't believe they're ever going to go away. That maybe in some sense I was slightly better prepared than someone who had never had any neurological problems. But I think, you see, this question of You know, vulnerability is very important because everyone who gets sick feels vulnerable, whether you have the flu or whether you're diagnosed with some, you know, terrible ongoing illness. And I think that it's very easy to feel victimized by illness. But, you know, everybody is ill at some point or another. And how we think about the illness, even if it's chronic, it seems to me is essential to how we live with it. And so my search here was to try to find a sense, a narrative, a story that I could live with. And I could say at the end of the book, I am the shaking woman. She's part of me.
One of the things that has helped you with the pain of the migraines and the uncertainty of the seizures is biofeedback. Would you explain what it is and why you think it's been helpful?
I will. I had suffered a migraine for a year. This is a long time ago.
A year-long migraine.
I was very ill. I was ill all the time. And finally, the doctor put me in the hospital at Mount Sinai in New York, gave me Thorazine, which is an antipsychotic medicine, heavily sedates you. And I was supposed to be in for 10 days. I actually continued to feel the migraine under this huge drug, and I left after 8 days. Then the neurologist, who I think was quite tired of me because I refused to respond to any medicine, suggested biofeedback. Biofeedback is essentially monitored meditation. You are hooked up with electrodes to a machine, and the more tense you are, the faster this machine beeps. So when you're very tense, it goes beep, 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 beep. And the more you relax, the slower the beeps. And when you're extremely relaxed, or as the psychologist who taught me how to do this called it, Buddha land, the noise stops. Well, it took me about 8 months, but I really trained myself to do this. And I can warm my extremities now by doing this deep relaxation and also take away some of the pain of my migraines. So that's been a genuine tool for me.
And it's maybe given you some sense that you can control the nervous system that always seems out of control.
That's right. I think the sense of control, even a little bit of control, or even being able to have some intellectual sense of what's going on with you, all of those are helpful.
Being a writer, naming things must be very important for you, finding the word that best describes something. And there isn't a name for the seizures that you have, because the name isn't epilepsy, the name isn't panic attack. No one really knows what the name is because there isn't a diagnosis yet. The title of your book is The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves, because the closest you've come is to saying, yeah, I'm the shaking woman. Do you wish that there was like a name for it, so that you could say, I have this. This is the problem.
I think there is comfort in naming, and most of us feel it when we're diagnosed with something. We say, oh, that's what it is. Either relief or fear response, whatever, but it's kind of nice to have it framed. Part of what I was trying to do in the book was to show how frail many of those frames, boxes, categories that we have are. In other words, there is no single absolute answer often for many illnesses, and what was called something in the 19th century is called another thing in the 21st, and it doesn't necessarily mean that the 21st century explanation is superior to the 19th century one. So I am, in a way, creating ambiguities inside the book. I wanted to show how hard it can be with all diagnostic categories.
So you were saying that before public speaking appearances, now you medicate. You take a medication that's basically like a beta blocker, like in
Yes.
Which a lot of people take for stage fright.
Absolutely.
So if you don't mind my asking, did you medicate before the interview that we're doing now?
Yes, I'm fully medicated. I did. I have propranolol in my system, which I think, you know, shuts down these eruptions of stress hormones, which I have a feeling are, you know, putting me into seizure mode. And so I'm completely beta blocked talking to you.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I had a great time. Thanks for having me. I had fun.
Siri Hustvedt is the author of the new memoir, The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. You can read the first chapter and see how Siri Hustvedt spells her name on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ricky Gervais became famous worldwide for starring in and co-creating a British TV series that only a few million Americans have seen, the original version of The Office, which was first shown in England on the BBC. The American version, starring Steve Carell on NBC, is one of the 8 international versions of The Office, with more on the way. After The Office, Gervais went on to create Extras with his writing partner Stephen Merchant, and he co-wrote and stars in the film The Invention of Lying, which just came out on DVD. Our TV critic David Bianculli spoke with Ricky Gervais last week. They began by talking about his latest project, an animated HBO series, The Ricky Gervais Show, which airs Fridays. It features the freewheeling conversations which he recorded with Stephen Merchant and a radio producer, Carl Pilkington, who's the real star of the show. These were initially produced as podcasts which made it into the 2007 Guinness Book of World Records as the most downloaded podcast on the Internet. What did they talk about? Here's an example. Stephen Merchant is posing this hypothetical question to Carl Pilkington. If you could choose any superpower, what would it be?
Remember, you've already got opposable thumbs. Cross that one off the list.
Oh, go on, Carl.
There are so many to choose from. Telepathy, X-ray vision.
Flight. Invisibility.
Choose it wisely.
Strength. Intelligence.
But why have I been picked?
Oh, for God's sake.
No, but I'm just saying...
Rob's question you.
But I'd just say, does anyone else want this?
Ricky Gervais, welcome to Fresh Air.
Pleasure to be here.
I love that he's immediately questioning the premise.
Yeah, of course, he doesn't. He's quite cautious, and he asks questions that you never dreamt he would ever ask or need to ask. He hasn't got a pretentious bone in his body. I think it's impossible for him. The concept of pretension does not exist in his world. So everything you get is unfiltered and honest. He downloads his brain for your pleasure. I mean, I think what he comes down to eventually when pressured is invisibility. And we ask him what he'd do with this, and he decides that he'd go into a shop and, you know, be invisible, wait for the shop to shut, and then he would shop at his leisure, buy some records, pay for them, and leave. That's what... he would use his superpower for. I mean, we were doing one audiobook, I think it was the Ricky Gervais Guide to Philosophy, and I posed him the Robert Nozick scenario, where if you could script your life, perfectly pre-programmed your life, you could get into a float tank and you'd live a virtual life, a perfect life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, would you choose that or reality with all the pain and suffering? And but it's real, and I think most people would probably choose a real life. Carl pondered this, and his virtual life, his perfect existence, turned out to be exactly the life he's got now, but his boiler would work. And again, I don't think he was making the most of the opportunity.
Well, you know, I always look at it thinking, is he putting you on? Is he putting me on? And then I finally decided, tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, that that Carl Pilkington is to you and Stephen Merchant what Margaret Dumont was for the Marx Brothers. I mean, someone who has no clue how funny you are, much less how funny they are.
Yeah. I mean, Carl, I don't know what Carl laughs at in his own life, what he finds amusing. He's quite a serious... You'd think he was a tortured, troubled soul, but he's not. He's just quite happy doing the stuff he does. He's, the only time he's not happy is when he can't get to do the same stuff he does every day. He likes pottering around. He likes doing nothing. He likes sitting in tea shops, eating cake with his girlfriend. He's just... He's totally happy with that. He actually said he's looking forward to being old. He said, one, he said, old people are no trouble. I don't know what that meant. Mm-hmm. They're no trouble. Like, you can wrangle them easy or they don't get into fights. I don't know. Yeah. But he says he's looking forward to being old because then you can just sit out in the street in a chair and no one gives you dirty looks like you're lazy. I mean, that's an ambition. That's a hell of an ambition, isn't it?
I have one last question about the Ricky Gervais show, and that's the animation style. I know that there were fans who were sort of doing animated versions of some of the podcasts, and then you come out with a TV show version of it, which is brilliant recycling, if nothing else. I'm wondering, yep. Is the animation style, is it based more on Flintstones, Hanna-Barbera, or Rocky and Bullwinkle?
Certainly, that was the remit. I did a sketch of myself initially for the animation house, and I wanted it to be a cross between Hanna-Barbera and 1950s children's comics of Britain, like the Beano and the Dandy. And there was a very good reason for that. I wanted it to be warm and approachable and not spiky and trendy and innovative in that sense. Because for two reasons, I wanted people to know that this is quite a nice, cuddly show. Because on the face of it, it's quite challenging. We're talking about, you know, there are no taboo subjects. We talk about race, disability. And I wanted people to know it was, like, safe and sweet. And Carl is quite childlike. Anything he says is not malicious. He doesn't wish harm on anyone. I mean, he's fascinated by difference. But I think in the best way, in the same way that a child is. A child stares because he hasn't seen it before. There's no malice. It's the parents that are embarrassed when they say, don't look. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are embarrassed socially. A child's just looking at stuff. And Carl's like that. Carl is like that. Carl is asking genuine questions without prejudice. The fact that he comes out with horrendous statements, I have to explain to people that he's an idiot. He thought that Anne
How
Frank,
nice of you to explain that.
Well, of course, I have to. It's my job. but he thought that Anne Frank was just avoiding paying rent. We had to explain to him that she was hiding from the Nazis because he has no formal education. He doesn't, you know, it's like people take things for granted because we've been learning all our life and from an early age, and now we think everyone knows these things, but Carl doesn't. Carl doesn't know these things. Throughout the podcast, throughout the 5 or 6 years, there's things that seem so obvious to us that are revelations to him. And I think that people should know that, that they're going to see over this, you know, these however many seasons we do, we're going to see Carl get slightly more educated. I mean, even arrogant in his stupidity sometimes, where he gets more confident, which is my favourite, like, you know, a la Homer Simpson. There was one point I was trying to explain evolution to him.
Oh, yes.
And he went, yeah, yeah. He said, I've got the gist of it. I go, go on. He went, I know it went germ, fish, mermaid, man. Mermaid. Unbelievable.
We're speaking with Ricky Gervais, co-star and co-creator of BBC's The Office and of the HBO series Extras and the new Ricky Gervais Show, which premiered last month and airs Fridays on HBO. Here in the States, The Office was shown on BBC America and seen by a couple of million people. So most people haven't seen you in America for the role for which you are so internationally famous. They know the NBC version, but they haven't seen you as David Brent. And I thought that I'd start off this section by playing a clip from The Office.
There's good news and bad news. The bad news is, Neil will be taking over both branches, and some of you will lose your jobs. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
God.
Those of you who are kept on will have to relocate to Swindon if you want to. So, yeah. Stay. I know. I know. Gutting. Gutting. You didn't see me. On a more positive note, the good news is, I've been promoted. So, every cloud. You're still thinking about the bad news, aren't you?
I do think that's one of the most pitch-perfect characters and comedies ever done for television. And
thank you very much.
It seemed fully formed at the beginning. And I'm wondering if you really had that sort of confidence going in both the character and the presentation from the very start.
Yeah, I was confident in the character. It didn't feel like an acting job. It felt like I was doing an impression of someone I'd never met before, which I suppose is what acting is, really. But I was much more worried about the realism of the piece. I wanted to keep in all the fluffs, all the mouth touching, all the things that rustled the microphone. Directorially, the realism, the motivation, the players. I always hated exposition. You know, when people would come in and say, John, you know your sister, the one who went to the Gambia?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course I do. She's my sister. Why are you, you might as well look at the camera. And so we tried to avoid that, and we tried to make everything organic. We didn't want people entering, doing a scene, and then leaving in opposite directions. So we had to find them. And I think that's what people connected with initially, was the realism of the piece and saying, I know someone like that. And we peppered them with the annoyance of mundane life. You know, some people say that drama is real life with the boring bits taken out. Well, we left them in and we made a feature of them. And the aftermath was so much more tantalising to us than the event. You know, what happens after someone's told a bad joke that didn't go down well?
Right.
That's a bit of an awkward, moment.
Extras was the series that you did after The Office. And you play Andy Millman, a film extra who desperately wants to get speaking lines in the films in which he appears. And as the series goes on, he succeeds in that quite wildly. But I want to play this early clip. This is one of my favorite moments from the series. He's an extra in a movie about a nun who hides Jews from Nazis during World War II. And your character, Andy, is dressed as a Nazi, and the movie's star, Kate Winslet, is in costume as a nun. And between scenes, they have this little chat.
I'd just like to say, I think, you doing this is so commendable, using your profile to keep the message alive about the Holocaust.
My God, I'm not doing it for that. I mean, I don't think we really need another film about the Holocaust, do we? It's like, how many have there been? We get it. It was grim. Move on. Now, I'm doing it because I've noticed that if you do a film about the Holocaust, guaranteed an Oscar. I've been nominated 4 times. Never won. And the whole world is going, why hasn't Winslet won one?
Yeah.
That's it. That's why I'm doing it. Schindler's Bloody List. The Pianist. Oscars coming out of their arse.
It's absolutely hilarious. And what makes it even funnier, of course, is that, years
life
later...
Life imitated art.
Yeah,
exactly.
She won an Oscar for The Reader, and which was a Holocaust film. And we know, because you were on the Oscars as a presenter, what you said to her that night. What did she say to you?
She just laughed. She laughed. We've actually done a retrospective that's coming out in April in England about extras, and we've got all the stars to chat about their episode. And she says on there, Ricky Gervais thinks that Oscar's half his. It's not.
What do you think the percentage is?
I think about 50-50. She can have about half it. She'd keep the Globe.
Well, you know, here was an idea, a really different idea for a television series where you get to show pieces of these actual films, and therefore it's the perfect excuse to bring in guest stars. But the series is not about those movies at all. It's about your ambition and your friendships and
I suppose it's I think people, you know, obviously the big names got the press heat that, you know, that was, I think it was remarkable that we got Kate Winslet and Sam Jackson and Robert De Niro and David Bowie to pop up in a little sitcom. I mean, it was remarkable. But I think I'd rather do stuff that makes a big connection with a few people than a small connection with loads. I'd rather this be a few people's favourite show than, you know, millions and millions of people's 10th favourite show, because what's the point otherwise? And that's what I wanted to do. And also, even though the backdrop of it looks like it's media, it's not. Just like The Office wasn't really about selling paper, it was about a few people thrown together, you know, an arbitrary existence, walking the same carpet every day. And Extras wasn't really about filmmaking and film stars. It was about a group of friends trying to get on with different ambitions. It was important that we made them the bottom rung of the ladder, because no one wants to see, you know, unfeasibly handsome, brilliant people doing brilliant things. Where's the fun in that? Yeah. We want to see a struggle. We want to see people falling over but getting themselves back up on their feet. And that's what's extraordinary. Ordinary people, their struggle. There's nothing as interesting as real life out your window. You walk down the street for half an hour, I'll give you half an hour of drama.
Religion is a continuing theme in your work, and especially the way that you espouse opinions through your characters about atheism. This is during an episode of Extras, the same one with Kate Winslet. And in this one, you have, you know, nuns and Nazis walking around in costume as extras. And Andy, your character, is talking with his best friend, a fellow movie extra played by Ashley Jensen. She's now on the TV series Ugly Betty here in the States. In this scene, she plays Maggie, a sweet but not very bright young woman, who tells Andy there's something about the movie they're filming that bothers her.
All these people going about pretending to be nuns.
What do you mean?
Do you think that's right?
It's a film.
I know, but they're all like wandering around as holy ladies. Won't that offend God or something?
Offend God or someone?
But does it not worry you a bit?
No. What, offending God? I'm an atheist.
What one's that? Is that the one where you haven't decided what you want
to do? No, it's agnostic. I'm an atheist. I firmly believe there is no God.
Why?
What do you mean, what? The burden of proof's not on me. The burden of proof is on the people who say there is a God. I don't believe in God. I believe in science.
So do you not believe in anything like ghosts or spirits or anything?
No, I believe in ghosts or spirits or elves. It's certainly not God, no.
So what do you think happens when you die?
Well, if you're buried, you go in the ground and you're worm food.
See, I don't like that. I would rather believe that there is a God and your soul just floats away onto eternity and all your friends from school will be there, like all the ones you haven't seen for ages and all your dead pets and just like, oh, nice people. You don't have to worry about worms.
You believe in God, then?
Now, what are you thinking as you replay this?
I think that was a very sweet, funny clip that actually housed a very important point. It was someone who that was genuine, and her reasons for believing in God were that the alternative wasn't very nice. And I think that's a lot of people's reason for believing in God. That if there isn't a God, what's the point? Why are we here? Why are we born and we live this life of struggle and pain if there's nothing at the end of it? Well, I wish there was a God, but I can't believe in something that I don't. And I suppose that is personal in a sense, although it's not personal to talk about religion because of the effect it has on society as a whole.
I don't know what your own upbringing was. I know that you were one of four children, but I don't know if you grew up in a religious household, if you...
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I'm very working class. upbringing. My dad was a labourer. My mum was a housewife. And I don't know how much they believed, but I know for a working-class mother, Jesus is like an unpaid babysitter. If she's not watching me, someone is. And also I think that, you know, the best you can hope for in a, you know, poor working-class accommodations is not that your son becomes an international comedian, but that he doesn't die in a barroom fight
mm-hmm.
before he's clever enough to take, you know, care of himself. And, that, you know, I think that if you're a God-fearing person and you live, you know, your life by Christian values is a good rule of thumb, then you'll probably be okay. And so, you know, she did her best. And I believed in God till I was 8. And I remember I was doing some homework from the Bible, and my brother, who was a lot older than me, he was 11 years older than me, he was about 19, he came in and he just said, "Why do you believe in God?" And my mum went, "Bob." And I knew that she had something to hide and he had something to tell me.
Now, watching television in the States right, you know, during the Olympics, it was unavoidable to see promos for Jerry Seinfeld's new series, The Marriage Ref. And at some point, you started getting promoted on that as a guest. Now, it looks like it's a panel show with comedy, and you're famously not married in real life, correct?
Yeah, I'm not. You'd say I wasn't married in the eyes of God.
Oh, or in the eyes although, of a civil, yes.
Although, you know, I am with the same woman that we've lived together for 25 years. So I think we're probably more stable than most marriages.
Okay.
I think that's probably above average.
And my question
in terms
was
of longevity.
Yeah. Okay. And my question was not, I was not trying to question your personal relationship so much as to question your experience on The Marriage Ref. What was that like?
Yeah.
Who were you with?
Myself, Madonna, and Larry David. I mean,
oh,
there's a
what
dream
was
team.
The green room like for that show?
Wow. It was the strangest show I've ever been on with us just giving. I mean, I can't imagine three more different opinions. And it was great to see how the panelists interacted as well. At one point, Madonna has a go at Larry David, accused him of being a misogynist because he's always coming down on the side of the man. I mean, Madonna arguing with Larry David. Oh, well, I did lose it a few times. I was saying, this is weird. What am I doing here? I mean, look at this. What, Larry David, Madonna and Ricky Gervais giving people advice. I mean, is that the first point of call? That people are having trouble with their marriage, they go, well, call Madonna. Call Larry David. Call that fat bloke from England. But they do a good job. I don't think you'd have seen a panel show quite like it.
Well, panel shows as a TV critic is something that I miss, and that's a troika that I really would like to see on television.
I've never done them before. I've never do panel shows. But when Jerry Seinfeld calls you on your cell phone and says, "Hello, it's Jerry Seinfeld here. Do you want to do a show with Madonna and Larry David?" The answer's yes. The answer's yes. I'll never have that opportunity again.
When you do award shows, what's your opinion afterwards about how the people in those specific rooms react to what you're saying? What comes off better than you expected? What doesn't?
You know, I think you've got to assume that when you do comedy, if it's got any edge at all or is worth anything, that as many people are going to dislike it as like it. You know, you can't choose your sense of humour. It's like sexuality. You can't pretend to laugh at something you don't find funny. You know, it's very peculiar and very personal. So you can only do stuff that, you know, you find funny, and I hope it's entertaining. But with that, you know, there are caveats. I don't want to just go out there and do safe anodyne stuff that everyone will find mildly amusing, but, you know, they could do it themselves. Likewise, I don't want to go out there and bring the room down. I don't want to go out there. It was funny because the Mel Gibson gag, where I said, "I like a drink as much as the next man, unless the next man is Mel Gibson."
Yeah.
There was one journalist in New York said, I noticed Mr. Gervais had a go at Mel Gibson's alcoholism, but failed to mention his anti-Semitism. Yeah, that would have been a nice half hour, wouldn't it? Yeah, let's talk about the Holocaust. And well done to Glee.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't the forum for it. I wasn't giving anyone a hard time for their personal beliefs. I was having a laugh. I was ribbing the people who are much more successful and famous and richer and more handsome than me. But it was all done in good fun. I had no targets. I've got nothing against those people. But likewise, as I say, I don't want to go out there and make it very, very stuffy and safe and just anodyne. So you've got to do it for yourself. And I think I pitched it about right.
Ricky Gervais, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Ricky Gervais spoke with Fresh Air's TV critic David Bianculli. Gervais's new HBO animated series, The Ricky Gervais Show, airs Fridays on HBO. It's adapted from his podcasts with Stephen Merchant and Carl Pilkington. You can learn about Carl Pilkington's theory of human reproduction in a clip from The Ricky Gervais Show on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.